This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Charlotte Mayor Vi Lyles is back for her monthly visit. Red light cameras, affordable housing, our bid to host the Republican National Convention, and the mayor's youth employment program are all on the table for discussion and more. And we want to hear your questions and comments, too. Reach us at charlottetalks at WFAE.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook, if you're on Facebook still. Get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks, and you can also watch us on Facebook Live. Mayor Lyles, welcome back.
Good morning.
Good to see you. You look tired. Are you tired?
Well, it's been a busy week this week. We've done a number of speeches, and I've had a great time. Last week I went out to UNC Charlotte and spoke to the Girls Alliance. We gave award and certificates to young women doing enormously challenging projects, and they were all under the age of 15.
Wow.
So that was really cool. And we've had a number of things. We had a budget workshop yesterday, so that's a big deal to start talking about issues like stormwater, your water bill. And we also went into some review of some of the major issues, police retention and recruitment, our capital program, affordable housing, those kinds of things. So we've been busy.
Yep. And we're going to have City Manager Marcus Jones on with you next month, specifically to talk about some of the budget discussions that are going on.
Yes.
And you'll have a little better idea of where that process is by that time.
The manager recommends the budget to the council on May the 7th, and then we ask people to come out, and we call it a public hearing, but I ask people to come and tell their stories about how the budget impacts them, good, bad, or indifferent. I think we need to hear from the community as much as possible as we make these tough financial decisions.
Well, you heard from the community on Monday night, at the council meeting on Monday night, about affordable housing. A lot of people showed up, evidently, and many of them talked about feeling the squeeze of rising rents. How many people were there on Monday night?
Oh, I would say we had at least 50 people there talking about supporting the effort, saying that rents are impacting them. People, we had a veteran who lives in Matthews, actually, say that when he came here, he was paying approximately 40% of his income in Social Security towards his rent, and it has escalated and escalated to a place where he has very little disposable income after paying rent.
Steve Harrison in The Observer wrote about him. He's a Vietnam vet, 71, moved into his apartment. He was paying $550 a month, about 40% of his income.
Yes.
And then new owners came in. They bought the complex. This kind of surprised me. They painted the countertops. They installed new appliances and then raised his rent. And he now pays 72% of his income in rent. And that goes well beyond the definition of being house poor.
Yes, and that's actually someone that's completely overburdened by their income with housing costs, and that's what we're talking about. I will tell you, Mike, I go a lot of places in this community, and it doesn't matter. You know, most people have seen housing as an issue of poverty, but it is not. It is an issue for all of the middle class as well. We were out at a South Park meeting on neighborhood improvements, and a woman walked up to me with her special needs child, and I hope you're listening today, and she said she had gotten a notice that her rent would go from $700 to $900, and she had 30 days to come up with the difference. And she said, my life, I had planned it on that lease of $700. Now, this situation is typical.
Had her lease not expired. And they can do that?
And I don't know if they can do that. I told her that she needed to check with some folks, but it just shows you the developmental pressure. That's just an example of where people come in and they redevelop and they want a return on their investment, and so rents are increasing. Mm-hmm. Then the new units that we're building are very expensive in certain locations. We've been struggling with this for a long time. When I came to work for the city in the late 70s, we were working with Judge McMillan on a court order for housing. We did scatter site housing as a result of that court order. And here I sit today as mayor of the city, and we're still talking about affordable housing and housing for people that live and work in Charlotte. And I believe it's time for us to take a major step And so yesterday, I asked the city manager to tell us or give us a scenario where we would put $50 million on our bond referendum this fall for affordable housing. And I'm really inviting the community to come in and talk about this. This is a big community decision that we've got to make. And I hope that people understand the crises that we're having right now, not just for the very poor, but for people that work two and three jobs.
I want to talk about that $50 million bond issue that you're asking for in a second here. But evidently, rents all over the, I'm going to say all over the city, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, have risen 36% in the past 5 years. Is that, in fact, all over, or is that just in certain pockets? Is it in the area of affordable housing? Is it in the area of luxury housing? Where is that 36%?
Now, I'm not sure who at the source of the 36% is, okay. But I hear and feel that this is going on in every segment of the market.
And this is development driven?
It is. I think we have a tremendous growth. When we talk about those 44 people moving to Charlotte every day, you know, they don't all come with a job. Sometimes they come anticipating that they'll be able to find work. And when that doesn't work out, they're scrambling for what to do. But even we've got it every segment of the market, the folks that are coming in with really good paying jobs and the revitalization of our center city, we're seeing rents go up. It's a matter of the idea that we have great demand for housing and not enough supply. And so that's why rents can go up. Mm-hmm. So
mortgage payments go up, too. Mine just went up, and it went up because I didn't have enough money in my escrow account because to take care of there was evidently a tax or an insurance increase. So when you raise taxes in Mecklenburg County, and I don't know whether the city is part of that equation or not for mortgage interest for mortgage loans, but mortgages go up. Is that a consideration when you look at the budget and you look at things that need to be funded through taxes?
You know, I think that, you know, you make a lot of personal decisions about your mortgage. You make a decision of whether or not you have, you know, like a, short-term, mortgage, whether you do 15, 20, or 30 years, you may decide to upload. And the insurance and the taxes are things that, again, insurance, you decide. So if not knowing your situation, but we do have an impact. Your mortgages are, if you escrow, you take your taxes out of your mortgage payment. But we haven't raised taxes in a while. Yeah. And so the difference is probably your insurance. You need to check on that.
I do need to check on that. Can you handle that for me?
No, okay. I don't think that's on my that's not on my list today.
So you used the term, when you talked about affordable housing, you used the term crisis. Does that place it at the top of your list of priorities?
You know, this has been on the top of our priority list since 2016, when we made the community commitment that we would help people have good paying jobs and where we would build 5,000 units in 3 years and that we would support great neighborhoods. I think the crisis comes that we need to do more very quickly, and our traditional $15 to $20 million is not sufficient enough in our housing.
So how do you do more very quickly? Because the city, as you pointed out, has been talking about this for years, and I don't know how long ago you were first an employee of the city, but that's mm-hmm. when they were talking about it. Various studies have acknowledged the need. There's only so much the city can do by law. They don't let you do very much. So what can you do about it?
You know, our traditional role has been in gap financing, where we've used federal dollars to give people a down payment for home ownership, and where people have come in through the federal government housing programs where you can apply for affordable housing projects at 9% or 4% deals. I know too much information, but what we've been doing is doing gap financing, where a developer says, I can build this unit and charge an affordable rent if you will cover the gap in the financing between what would be market rate and affordable. And that's what the city has traditionally done with our housing trust fund, and that was innovative for so many years, but now that's kind of become the regular thing to do. So expanding our options is what we need to do, and the two or three things that keep rising to the top are where we can work with people that have already built apartments and keep those units affordable. They're called naturally occurring affordable housing. That's the new NOAA word for it. But basically, where someone built something, they've gotten their investment back, and it's time to make a decision whether or not to reinvest in the property or sell it. If they sell it, it's likely going to be in our environment of growth, a market rate that's going to be upper end. But if we can work with those owners and say, if you will deed restrict to an affordable rent, then we will help you with returning that investment to you.
There seems to be some debate on council as to whether the city's affordable housing money should be spent on the poorest of the poor or on workforce housing, which is for people like fire department employees and teachers and police officers who are working and they just don't make the kind of money you need to make to live affordably in Charlotte. And it's about $56,000 a year. That's the affordable housing figure there in terms of salary. Where do you stand on that? Should it be poorest of the poor housing or affordable housing?
I've been asked that question many times, and this is what I believe. And this is the way I approach most of the thoughts that I have, is that there's a balance in the city. And we can't pit poverty against poverty. Or affordability against affordability in our groups. We need to do more, and the pie needs to get bigger for everyone. And so the way I look at it is that we need to work with people to say, where is the greatest need, and work on that. But also by working with people that we can avoid them becoming homeless or avoid them from sliding where they don't have or they fall into that 30% category from the 60% or the 80% category, keeping them in an affordable place will make a difference. And so it's all together. So we balance this out. But the debate is there. And I wanted you to know it is truly a debate that the city council will have. But my position is let's make the pie bigger and address every need depending on what we can do. But we have to understand they're all connected. Everything is connected.
So let's go back to this individual, this Vietnam vet who's 71, who spoke at council on Monday night. He's 71. He started at his apartment. I don't know what year this is, but he started paying $550 a month, which was 40% of his income. Now they've raised his rent to the point where it's 72% of his income. He's probably retired. He's probably living on a fixed income here. What happens to people like that if you can't help them?
I think what happens is that they stop buying their medicines. I think that they begin to not drive a car. They look for transportation. They look for buses and trains to carry the ability to move around. I think that they change how they eat. And I think that that is something that people just gradually adjust to. Because if he's still in this apartment and he's gone from 40 to 72, what that means is he's made those personal adjustments, and there's probably no place else to go. To live on 28% of your fixed income is putting him in that category of greatest need.
How many people in Charlotte do you think fall into that category? Is this a minority of people? Is it the majority? Is it about 50%? What is it?
We've estimated that out of the households that they're probably the need for at least 30,000 affordable places to live, and that covers the spectrum from 0 to 80. So I don't know the relativeness, but if you look at the rest of our city, the way I see it is that they're great neighborhoods. They're great neighborhoods on the inner city and the suburban areas, but we don't have enough of the affordable type, and we do have a shortfall there of approximately around 30,000.
Mayor Vi-Lyles is with us. She's making the third of her in as many months consecutive visits with us. When we come back, we're going to talk about this $50 million that you've asked for, because normally the ask every 2 years for the Affordable Housing Trust Fund is $15 million. This is more than three times that. We'll talk about how that would work and what the chances for success are when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Hey, Charlotte Talks fans. You've heard a number of perspectives this hour on Charlotte Talks, and now we want to hear your perspective. Fill out our short listener survey right now on WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's our monthly visit. It's not going to be weekly. It's our monthly visit with Mayor
Vi Lyles. I'd love to be here every week, Mike. I learned so much. You have had some great shows over the last couple of days.
Thank you. It's been good.
We
are talking about a lot of different things, and we've started with affordable housing because the council got an earful about that on Monday night at the council meeting. And did you learn anything that you didn't know at that meeting from people who spoke about their need for affordable housing?
I actually think that the people that were coming in, they know what's going on. And I said 30,000 units, but it's really 24,000 units at or below the 50% paying more than they should for their rents, with one-third of the people paying more than they should at the 30% mark for their rent or their housing. Those folks know these numbers better than I do often. Mm. And when they're coming down, what they're saying to me is do something about it. They were there to support the efforts that we're undertaking in this community to build affordable housing. But I think it's always really, really good when we have people come down and actually explain, I was homeless, I'm now in an apartment, I've had a success moving there, but the rents are rising so much that I don't know that I can maintain it. So the stories are really important because these are people that live here, that work here, mm-hmm. and they're just letting us know what the real impact is of housing and the lack of our supply.
So you've asked, you floated the idea of a $50 million influx of cash coming into the housing trust fund. Every 2 years, the city floats a bond. It's usually $15 million to fund that trust fund. The trust fund is nearly out of money because we're coming toward the end of the 2 years. Mm-hmm. And you have asked for $50 million, and you were backed up in that ask by one of the people who spoke at that meeting, who thought $50 million was a good figure. If that is the sum that is finally decided upon, that's going to be placed on the November ballot in the form of a bond. What do the passage of bonds, particularly in that amount, do to taxes?
Well, I want to start off and say that, you know, $50 million wasn't just a number that I thought about. If we'll think back to the Affordability Task Force work, they identified housing as one of the legs that makes sure that we have stable families. And so they said in their recommendation after 2 years of study that they would recommend that the housing trust fund go up to $50 million. Now, they don't have to worry about how we pay for it in that report, but it certainly did tell us, then reinforce the need for housing at this price point. So when you ask me what does $50 million do, the first thing is that the council has to get comfortable with a bond amount. And what I really love about this system is that the citizens will decide, whatever that amount, whether it's enough or if they were willing to pay for it.
But it'll be an up or down vote. They're not going to be able to go into the voting booth and say, yeah, I think you need more money, but 50 isn't the figure, so I vote for 35. It's either going to be 50 or whatever the final number is or nothing.
And that's why we need people to come out for our public hearing on the 14th to say whether or not they're willing to support $50 million, because I think the council members will make that when they adopt the budget, make that decision. Mm-hmm. And I think that the people will tell the council what we need to do, but 50 would actually allow us to do so much more. And the reason that I said 50 in part is that, think about, if you bought a house 10 years ago, that house is appreciated. If we don't do something today, what is going to be the cost 5 years from now? We have rapidly increasing cost in construction, land acquisition costs, all of those things are going on. So why not take the dollar and get more out of it today mm-hmm. than 5 years from now or 10 years from
now? And you've asked City Manager Marcus Jones to come back to council and assess the impact of a $50 million bond issue. Is that going to be at the April 14th meeting or before that meeting?
That will be on May the 7th. He'll be able to tell
So citizens won't know the full impact when they come to you.
They will know by May 7th. They'll know, and
the
hearing is
April
on May
14th.
May 14th. I'm sorry.
Okay.
It's May 14th. Right. I apologize if I said April. Don't come in April the 14th because it's too soon. So come May the 14th. And if this community is willing to work and if we can explain it, I know that people understand this is probably one of the biggest moments in our history to make a difference in our community. And I believe that if we have the council take the lead on approving a bond referendum for $50 million, if we have the partnerships that have carried us so far in this community work with us, that we can leverage that money much more and we can get this done before it costs too much or we have the inability to finance it at all.
So how is this money used? If you get $15 million, if you get $40 million, if you get $50 million, if you get $100 million, how is it used? You put it in the trust fund. What do you do with it?
Well, you know, I think that what we need to do is say that we're going to put this money aside for housing. And the trust fund has ordinarily been used to cover gap financing for construction of new units. But we also have this idea of keeping affordable units that are already in the ground or already being used. And so we may be looking at rent subsidies to keep people in those apartments. So if the veteran had a subsidy that kept him from having to leave, if we could get his rent down to 60% and he had a rent subsidy, that would keep him from being evicted if prices go up again. So those are the kinds of things that I think are new ideas. Rent subsidies, keeping people that are in crises. A lot of times a health care issue or a temporary cutback in jobs. You know, you go to work one day and the guy comes up and he says, well, we don't need you for 40 hours. We need you for 24 for the next 6 weeks. If we can keep that person in their house, that prevents when they get that job back to 40 hours, we can make a difference that they can stay there. So lots of opportunities.
Is that how it works now? Right now?
It does not work that way right now. We don't have the capacity to do any more than what we've been doing, which is construction, gap financing for construction and helping people like the men's shelter renovate their projects. But if we have more, there are other options that are available that we can make a difference.
For years, New York City had rent control. Are we allowed to do that? Is that a good? Is that a bad idea, a good idea, an old-fashioned idea?
I think rent control is an old-fashioned idea.
Okay.
I think there's something about having the value of keeping people where they're contributing to their housing costs is important, but rent control kind of is this big governmental way of doing it.
Okay.
What I think is that government should help, but not really control and regulate in that regard.
One of the attendees at Monday night's meeting criticized the city for not putting more pressure on developers to include affordable housing in their new developments. Is that something you can legally do?
We have an incentive program now that allows for a bonus density. I give a shout out to Mayor Anthony Fox for doing that. But when you're in a community like this that's growing and it's easier to go ahead and build something that's more expensive, we have not had anyone take advantage of that program as an incentive. Whether or not we want to do something as a requirement requires a lot more work and study. And I believe that the development community is stepping up. And we had, when 20 years ago, we've only had one low-income housing developer or two, the Housing Authority and Charlotte-Mecklenburg Housing Partnership, two different markets. Now we have over six. So I think that we can grow this in a way that we're encouraging people to come in and build and renovate without having to go to a regulatory program.
So several people have been writing in as we've been talking about affordable housing. Jackie on Facebook says, we are a wealthy community. It's troubling that we can't find better solutions to provide low-income housing. Everyone is a vital part of this community, and people are feeling pushed out. We can't keep giving incentives and catering to the builders. $50 million is peanuts. I'm guessing the Panthers will ask for more for the stadium.
Well, I don't know what the Panthers will ask for. I'm not going to do that. But I agree with her on the idea that this community needs to have diversity of jobs and diversity of housing. And we're working hard to make that happen. And I hope, while $50 million may seem like peanuts, if we leverage that with other community efforts, I hope it multiplies. But $50 million to me is a major increase from 15.
Yeah.
It's something that, again, I believe it's the right number. So I hope it's not peanuts because it's more than anything that we've done. And I hope that you'll come down and talk about it and express that concern in your social media, publicly, in your book club, whatever is necessary so that people are informed.
Two other questions that kind of dovetail. Peter on Facebook asks, why is affordable housing concentrated in the West or Northeast, Charlotte? And Vanilla Coachella, writing on social media, asks, what is Mayor Lyle's take on low-income housing and the lack of spreading it evenly throughout Charlotte? I welcome my fair share in Highland Creek, but will South Park, etc., do the same? I get the impression we all want to do right by those in need as long as it's not in my backyard.
Wow. You're asking me to take on two big issues, and the first question is, why is it concentrated in the areas? That's that history lesson that I often talk about, redlining in the 30s and the 40s, when African-American neighborhoods weren't able to get loans through banks, private financing, and basically what may have been
the whole FHA system was set up.
The whole system was set up around discrimination.
Right.
And then, so you had people live where they could. And so I can't change history, but I can think about how do we move forward acknowledging that. So what I would say is there are some parts of our community where we ought to be talking about more home ownership than rentals. And some parts of our community, it's better to go ahead and try to do more rentals. I think we do need to have an ability for people that live throughout our community at affordable rates. So, yes, I support our locational policy being revised in a way that allows people to take their decision of where they live. There are governmental restrictions. I can't tell you. Like, one says you can't get a 9% or a 4% deal if the grocery store is not within 1 mile of the site. So we've got to deal with a lot of that kind of thing that, you know, blocks us in some regards from making advancements. But we all want to have the ability to have housing across the city, across our boundaries and geography.
Scott must be just joining us on Facebook because he writes, how does a fit, or maybe we skirted over it, but how does a $50 million bond release affect taxpayers? And that's something that you've asked the city manager.
I've asked the city manager.
And we'll get a better answer for that in May.
We will. And the thing that I think is that, remember, this, while the council recommends, the voters will decide.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mass transit is seen as a vehicle for people who can't afford cars, and we need to get more people into mass transit, whether they can afford a car or not, because our roads are congested, et cetera. And the Lynx Blue Line was built for that effort, but also as a development tool. And as the Lynx Blue Line went in South End, very little of the construction surrounding it is affordable.
That's right.
And as it goes now to the north, construction is beginning, and will any of that be affordable? Because the city council plan 15 years ago recommended that the city buy land along the northern stretch of the corridor, which is now open, to build affordable housing. That didn't happen, did it?
That did not happen, and it didn't happen because there was some concern by the council at the time that would concentrate housing in a way that would negatively impact the areas that were currently in existence.
Okay.
I can't understand completely that debate because I think when you look at what's being constructed today, it's very difficult to tell the difference between the traditional kinds of public housing that people saw and what we're doing now because the housing is being built exactly the same. But that decision was made. So we are going to be continuing to develop our rail system, and we are going to have a very deliberate debate about whether or not when we acquire land for transit, do we include acquisition of land for affordability for housing along those routes. We missed it, but we can always go back and do something different as we grow.
And you're speaking tonight, I believe, with former mayor and former U.S. Secretary of Transportation Anthony Fox about the supply of affordable housing at 7 o'clock at Friendship Memorial Baptist Church. Will you be saying anything there that you'd like to add to this conversation?
Actually, Mike, I was doing that this morning at 7 a.m. before coming over here.
7
a.m. with Secretary Fox. And 7 a.m. is it can be an early day, and especially if you have to drive to over seven on yes. 77. Well, so
I was still in my jammies.
So yeah, well, I wasn't. I was there with Secretary Fox, and we talked about this, and he made the connection between having accessibility and being someone that has to go to work on a schedule every day, that we really do need to think, how do we have the ability to allow families not to have a car?
Right.
To be able to come on the going to and from work downtown for under $5. I mean, you can't park downtown for $5, but the reliability of bus and train service is very, very important to the growth of our city and the affordability of it.
So let's switch to something we talked about a little bit last time you were here. That's red light cameras. We talked about your desire to investigate bringing them back at intersections or certain intersections. We had them, but there was a law change back then that suddenly required 90% of the revenue collected from those cameras to go to the schools, and that prohibited us from paying the company their fee for those cameras, so we took them out. City Council talked about this issue that you want to see come back. They were kind of lukewarm. That's my description of it. You can have your own in a second. The city manager, Marcus Jones, advises against them, and he pointed to Vision Zero, which is the city plan to address safety in a more holistic manner. But the idea isn't dead. So what is your impression of how the council reacted to it, and where does this idea stand?
Oh, my gosh. So, you know, the world changes so quickly. When I was on council and I asked about this, there were two communities that had special agreements with their school system that allowed them to institute this. Since then, one of them has been sued by someone that says that you're violating our constitutional requirement. And that just changed everything. So when we were going to do red light cameras, as I thought we were a year ago, we would have had an agreement with the school system. We would have paid for the system's operation and given them the money that was after followed that, and they would be able to take all of that. Well, right now we're in court, and I think our advice from our city attorney is that if we use red lights, we would go back to where we would have to give 100% of the operating costs as well as any fines to the school system. That changes things. Mm-hmm. And I think the new debate is, well, are we willing to pay or absorb $2 million for red light cameras out of our operating fund? And what the manager did, perhaps he thought I was smarter in articulating this, but what he really was saying is that $2 million that you would have to pay for the red light cameras, where could you invest that in other tools in the toolbox to get better traffic control? The debate was interesting, all the way from Mr. Winston, who says, well, we ought not have cameras at all. There are too many cameras already out here. He suggested, well, let's just do a huge education and marketing campaign. All the way to people that said, well, let's consider it. We might need to pay that money just so that we can have the red light cameras.
We have to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk some more about that and whether or not $2 million is too much to pay for the problem it solves. We'll come back in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Mayor Vi Lyles for one of her monthly meetings with us on this program. Nice to have you here every month. Let's go back and talk some more about red light cameras. $2 million was the figure you threw out. I actually thought it was $1 million, but it's $2
million. Oh, that was a couple of years ago for one. So
the problem that red light cameras allegedly solve, which is what? What is the problem?
Well, the idea is that we have people that drive through after the light is turned red, mm-hmm. and that's dangerous for jackknives. There's been some data about, well, does it cause people to stop abruptly and cause rear end? So it's not really clear in terms of it as a deterrent, but it was something that we felt had merit.
So is it a $2 million problem? I mean, how many people run red lights on a regular basis? How many accidents has it caused? Does it cause on a weekly basis, a monthly basis, a yearly basis? How big a problem is this?
Well, I don't know the number of cars, but I would say that if you stand at many of our major intersections, you can clearly identify it as a problem. They're especially when peak hour traffic is going on. People just kind of, I got to get there. I mean, I really feel like that we have a traffic issue here.
Oh, yes.
And a safety issue for pedestrians. And if we're going to become a walkable city, we've got to do something about it. So the question is, what's the best way to spend our money to do something? Crosswalks are working in other communities. There are opportunities to perhaps do more enforcement with our police officers and target that. All of those things that are in that toolbox, repainting some lines, putting in more signals, changing our signals, we are going to continue to work on that traffic issue.
How about better timing the signals so that when the traffic flows better, so people don't feel compelled to inch through that last light or they'll get held up?
Yeah, I think in our, especially in our downtown area, we do have really good traffic control on our major thoroughfares, and they're all systematically done by, you know, the broadband operation of these cameras. But I still think that people kind of feel like, well, I'll just take that last turn,
okay,
or that last, go through that last light.
You've asked Marcus Jones to come back with specific alternatives to improve safety. When's that to happen?
Well, we're in the middle of budget right now, which and budget is our major concern because it's our major policy document. You do what you fund. And we take that right now. So I would expect, we asked him if he could come back in about 8 weeks. But I think right now we are really focused on our budget. Okay. And until that is done.
Well, you have a fan who agrees with you, Will on Facebook. I lived here when we had red light cameras. He says they were a positive solution to reduce so many folks running lights. Side impacts from drivers rushing through red lights are deadly. Some argue red light cameras would increase rear end accidents, but it's much less serious than a high speed impact. We should work together to make this life-saving program.
He's captured it very, very well. That's exact. You've articulated that much better than I did, so I appreciate it.
So, Charlotte has submitted its bid to host the Republican National Convention in 2020. They did that last week, I believe.
Yeah.
And WBTV reported this week that members of the host committee would soon be going to Washington for oral presentations. Do you know who the people are making that pitch?
Well, let me just talk a little bit about that. The host committee is generally the group that is put together to work on the outcome. They are the operating arm for any convention, just like we had Dr. Murray running the host committee for the 2012 convention that was held here. It's all of those people coming together to make the city shine. So those would be the people that would, I think, participate in any kind of presentation. What I believe on the, we submitted a bid, and it's absolutely one of those things that I have some big headlines for you, you know, but think about 2012. Spectrum Arena's a great location. The idea of our downtown, we have more hotel rooms than we had in 2012. So I expect, I actually work with the 2012 convention that we held here. And working on that, I think that any convention, Republican, Democratic, is going to look at, you know, security, hotel accommodations, and the community's commitment to provide volunteers and resources.
We got pretty high marks, if I recall correctly, for the Democratic National Convention in 2012.
Absolutely.
Although a lot of delegates found themselves staying in far-flung places because we didn't have enough hotel rooms. How many more hotel rooms do we have in close proximity to the arena now than we did back then?
I don't know the exact number, but I remember when 2012 was going on, La Meridian and the Sheraton were going through a renovation.
Right.
And I think that was renovations are complete. We have new hotels downtown, the Ivy, the Kempton.
And there'll be more by 2020.
And there will be more by 2020.
So did we learn anything from our Amazon bid and the way we approached that bid and the things that we said and did in the presentation that we made to Amazon that we applied to our pitch to the RNC?
You know, I don't think they're too comparables. The Amazon is an economic development recruitment, okay, and they're kind of having a contest, whereas I think the NRC is much more around their standard facilities and access decision-making. There is also the political side of it, that I think the president makes the final decision for his party where he's going to host, so we'll just see how that goes.
Former Congressman Robin Hayes, who's now the chair of the North Carolina GOP, commented on how Republicans, Democrats, and the business community came together to make this a strong bid. Did Republicans play a role in bringing the Democratic convention to town?
Well, I think we have to thank Senator Tillis, who is a Republican, and he was very, very engaged. He and I met for coffee, and he said, I think this is something that would really be a good idea for Charlotte. And I agree with him, perhaps for a little bit different reasons, you know, and when you can be the Republican host committee, you're going to be shining with so many people in this community. But I believe in this because I believe that Charlotte has always been a place where we are going to do what's best for our citizens. People say money, I say it's jobs.
I don't know that answered my question. My question was, did Republicans play a role in bringing the Democratic convention to town?
Oh, yes. We had Andy Doolin often reminds me, he was on the city council, and he actually was on the host committee. And I believe the Republican host committee will also mirror that effort to have Democrats. Okay. And I'm sorry, I didn't hear your question correctly.
Okay. That's all right. Robin Hayes called our participation in the Democratic committee and hosting the Democratic convention a good dry run for...
It's good to know Republicans have a sense of humor.
For what we can do for the Republicans. How many other cities in the running also have hosted political conventions?
I had one of the reporters tell me today that if you Google RNC 2020, the only city that comes up is Charlotte. So we've probably been the only city that has acknowledged our bid.
Well, the RNC says they need an 18,000-seat arena, 40,000 square feet of office space, 350,000 square feet of media workspace, and they want the media here, and parking for 2,500 cars. Do we have all that?
We have all that and more.
Okay. Nothing in that list, interestingly enough, about hotel rooms. We will have more hotel rooms than
In 2012. And we also have the Blue Line.
Right.
So when you start thinking about having to use a bus shuttle system, we've taken another 9.3 miles and made it easy to get around.
Right. When do you think we'll know something?
I don't know the answer to that.
So let's talk about something that is probably near and dear to your heart, and that is the Mayor's Youth Employment Program. I was going to ask you how long this program had been in existence. I know that it preceded you, and I was really surprised to discover it's been around for 32 years.
Yes.
Is it a well-known program?
I think it's well-known for the community that it serves. I think that if you ask generally the public, they probably not see it as vibrant as it is today. But we're approaching 800 participants. So perhaps when we get to that 1,000 or 2,000 mark, there'll be more visibility because we'll have more kids talking about it. But we will have 800 young people participate in this program.
That's your goal.
Is that a fact? 800.
Okay,
we have an 800. We're still asking people.
What did it used to be?
Oh, I can remember when it was like 100, 150. Okay. But it has grown. Every mayor, and I have to say this is a city program that every mayor has taken an interest in, and they've added and they've been committed to it. I remember Anthony Fox said that he was going to double it.
Mm-hmm.
But what it has happened, and I take give a lot of credit to our staff, Tom Warshauer and Don Hill. We now have resume writing classes. We talk about how you have to dress to go to work. We talk about how you have to show up on time. All those soft skills, the young people participating in this program have those throughout the school year. So that now that they're getting their assignments of where they're going to work 20 hours a week during the summer, they know that they're representing themselves in a way that's different than they would have probably done just any job application.
So let's be clear about this. Who are the young people who take advantage of this and who are offered this, and how do the two come together?
It is not a income-based program.
Mm-hmm.
It comes together through our school system. We are working very closely with Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools to identify children that want to participate in this program. And so it is not, as I said, there are no income restrictions. People that come forward and say, I am interested in this type of job. Kids today have a lot of opportunities. Some have more than others. So there may be a really strong idea within the school system to encourage those that don't have opportunities to participate in this one.
Are these jobs or are these internships?
These are internships
and they pay. Okay.
We do pay, and they're 20 hours a week, and we encourage teamwork. We encourage there's a training session for actually the people that are going to supervise the young person for those 20 hours to come in and say, here's how you work with our kids. Here's what they've learned and what you need to know about them. So it's a really great program.
I understand, and this actually kind of surprised me, so it may be incorrect information, so I'm going to ask you if it isn't. This is the first time, this year will be the first time in the history of the program that the city will work with the schools and with the county to try to double the number of internships?
Exactly. We had a press conference just a few days ago that the superintendent, Clayton Wilcox, and Dina DiOrio, county manager, came in and they talked about the opportunities within the school system to support the program as well as to use young people in their organizations, and so they've all stepped up to accept interns this summer.
So I was going to ask if the school system and the county and the city
City, yes. I'm looking forward to the young people that are going to work in my office. It's going to be really cool to have an intern this summer.
Clayton Wilcox, who is the superintendent of schools, says that these jobs help make education come alive because students get to see the ways in which they can apply some of the things they're learning in school. And you hope that this leads to these young people escaping poverty and that these summer jobs can offer them hope. What results has this program seen for these young people who have participated in it over 32 years?
Over these 32 years, young people have come out of this program with a role model that they can see and work and understand and call and build a relationship. And they go back to school. They don't drop out. They go back to school. But they also see career models, and they expand. If you always thought that you could only do this one thing and you have an internship in something entirely different, a new field, whether you thought that my only opportunity was to, you know, work in hospitality, what about healthcare? What about, you know, business? Those are the kinds of things that we see, and it's a successful program, and I hope that it continues to grow.
How many businesses are on board?
I can't remember the number, but we've been increasing the number of participants in the program, just like the school system and the county. We've got more businesses in as well.
Let's hopscotch through some things that have come in from listeners very quickly. I think everyone, John and Charlotte writes, I think everyone loves the idea of having non-motorized transportation options in the city, especially bikes, but really, they look like debris scattered all over the city and most inappropriately in suburban neighborhoods where they sit and sit and sit. I know this is a testing phase, but where are you collecting data and input and recommendations to move forward? I'd love to be part of the solution or at least register my input. Thank you very much.
Well, I think that, Mike, if you give me that person's email, we'll have some follow-up.
We can make
that happen. I know that's the biggest complaint that I hear is that, well, they're dropped off. But I think that you have to balance that with their being used. And we don't know the outcome of the results. We don't know if we've got too many bikes out there or just enough. But the numbers have been astounding for use.
Okay. School safety from Dave and Charlotte. School safety or school hardening are important topics right now. We know that our schools are funded primarily by state and county, and part of those funds are earmarked for school safety. Mayor Lyles, what role, if any, does the city have in that, in supporting school safety?
The role that we have is to work collaboratively with the school system. We have the police department and our chief and the school superintendent working together to talk about safety, and the chief of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools Police Department as well. So we have the opportunity to provide advice and counsel, and the school system and the school board make those final choices.
Ryan on Twitter, is there anything being done to bring a grocery store to the Five Points area on Charlotte's west side?
You know, that's a very tough question. We're going to try our very best to talk about that, but we know that retail follows rooftops.
Okay. Shay on Twitter, as a female combat veteran, I notice Charlotte is bustling with business opportunity, yet has a very high veteran homeless population. Where can developing organizations get direct, unobstructed funding to provide services and housing?
You should call the county, special services that are provided there. There is a veterans office in the county. Call them and see what you can work out.
And a final question from Carl on social media. We only have 15 seconds. If a new Panther owner comes in, wants to have a dome stadium away from downtown, which will mean a loss of parking revenue, what will be the city's response?
I don't know what the city's response will be.
Okay. Well, I didn't anticipate that response. You surprised me. Mayor Vialiles visits us every month. She's coming back next month, and we'll talk with her and with Marcus Jones, the city manager, about where the budget process stands. Actually, it's more fun than you think it is, but am I just talking about it?
Yes.
Thanks for the hour.
Thank you, Mike.